we were talking about the statement that, you know, d nu prime time ordering of psi of x prime that was equal to that was covariant. And the claim was that the time ordering of d mu psi of x d nu psi of x prime was not covariant. And I gave you kind of an indirect argument where you differentiated one and you saw that the difference was not covariant. But it wasn't completely compelling necessarily that that this one was going to be the covariant one and not this one. So a different view of that is if you just write out what this thing is. So take this in the vacuum just to make it explicit. I'm going to give you a reason where you can just directly see why this one's not covariant, whereas this one is. And that is, so the argument that this one's covariant is, you know, if you just calculated the Feynman propagator the way you always do, psi, then you know you get these two terms, right? Because there's the, if x naught is bigger than x naught prime, then you've got, you know, zero psi of x prime. And then you've got the other term where we take, you know, x to x prime. And this you just evaluate because you expand that guy in terms of the creation and annihilation operators. And you always get this expression where you, when you do that, which has got the form of, you know, so there's theta x naught minus x naught prime times this times I times an integral b3p over 2 pi cubed, times twice the energy, times, you know, we have e to the ipx, plus the x goes to x prime. And the main thing to I want to draw your attention to here is that p, you know, zero is by definition the function of momentum that corresponds to the dispersion relation, the square root of p squared plus m squared. And then you do the usual thing where you write this guy as a Fourier transform. You know, you use the you use the statement that, you know, theta of x is 1 over 2 pi I integral of e to the I omega x or omega plus I delta. Have I done that right? It's so if x is positive, then if you of course, I got it wrong. You know, there's two ways to write it, right? Integral e to the minus I omega x over omega plus I. Oh, it's always a sign to worry about. And, you know, the argument for why this is the Fourier transform of the step function is that if x is positive, then this thing will converge on an arc. You're doing an integral along the real axis here, minus infinity to infinity. And there's a pole, which is, in this case, just above the axis, on the imaginary axis. And so the thing is that if x is positive, then you can close the contour. You have to close the, if x is positive, you have to close, this thing is going to be exponentially damped for in the upper half plane. So you can close the contour in the upper half plane, and then you pick up the residue, and then that gives you the one. Whereas if x is negative, then you know, you're closing it the other way where you don't get the pole, and so you're going to get zero. And so, and the sine is coming in because that's what's making the arc infinity converge. And so when you use this representation for the step function, that gives you the normal form where this thing is now an integral d4p of 2 pi to the fourth of e to the I p dot x minus x prime divided by b squared plus m squared minus I delta bar. Well, that delta is not the same as this delta, but they're proportional. They're both positive, and they're both taken to zero at the end of the day. Okay. And the important thing is that in this p, that p is this integral omega, right? So this is integral d omega. And what's happened in writing things this way is, you know, P zero is basically omega. And so it's not connected to the three momentum. And so the statement normally would have been, this is actually also how you see, if you wrote the, this is kind of, what if you took Rayleigh-Schrodinger perturbation theory, the old-fashioned non-relativistic perturbation theory, the sum of these two terms for the two step functions, one involving the particle, one involving the antiparticle, it's those combining together into this Feynman propagator is the thing that's making everything manifestly covariant. And so it shows you again how the antiparticles are, them combining with the particles is what makes everything manifestly covariant. But then the story I want to tell you now is that the important difference between this and this is that the energy is different for the two. So if you kind of ask, what's the difference between this and this? Like, how could they be different? The difference is that this was covariant because P4P is covariant, and those are all covariant, and those are all covariant. If I differentiate them, I get something covariant because I pull down a P mu, P nu, and those P's are these P's, which are the ones that are, these P's, those are the ones that are all being integrated over, and so those are the ones which are covariant. But if I do the same thing before we do the time ordering, what's happening is that the P mu that comes down here has its energy component is epsilon of P. And so that's the thing where if I do a Lorentz transformation of these D4P, all of the components of P are changing, but the but you're not doing an independent integral over the energy in this case. And so the change of variables you would have done to make the, to prove the covariance of this whole thing is not there. And so that's why it's failing. So if there's a, you don't need to do this indirect argument to show why this is the not covariant one, is the point of this, point of that exercise. So that's an aside before we move on. The main thing I want to do this afternoon is I've been setting it up as if taking these toy examples. So we've been looking at the case where the interaction Hamiltonian was W mu times derivative of psi, and then it turned out to be a non-covariant piece in the Hamiltonian that had to be there, and these things conspired to make the S matrix, you know, 1 minus I integral h d4x minus I squared over 2 integral. So the story I said this morning was that if we just took this kind of this toy model where we had an interaction involving a derivative, then the failure of this thing inside the time ordering to be covariant cancels the appearance of this guy in this term, and then that's systematically happening order by order in the interactions. And that's all very nice, but you might say, but that's a very contrived example. The next thing I want to do is show you the same thing as happening with electromagnetism. So it's really a concrete in-your-face problem that if you want to deal with nature, with quantum field theory, you have to deal with. So I want to just repeat the exercise of doing the correlation function, but do it for the electromagnetic field. So we'll calculate the vacuum piece of this. So, and you can imagine that the calculation we could be doing is scattering involving charged particles, and we're just focused on the electromagnetic field part of that matrix element. And so if the initial and final state don't have photons in them, the photon fields in here are going to be the ones that pick up just the vacuum. So we're going to calculate a mu of x, a nu of x prime for the electromagnetic field. And this is a calculation which you can do just like this one, because we know exactly the consistency of Lorentz transformations for the fields and the particles tells us exactly how these things are related to the creation annihilation operators. We know what the creation annihilation operators do to the ground state. And so the same algebra goes through here. And I want to do it explicitly because there's a failure of covariance that appears there. And then we can ask, what would I have to, what we'll do is we'll imagine instead of doing this, we'll take a typical interaction between charged particles in electromagnetic field. And here's the covariant way it would couple. And there will be a story very similar to the one we did here, where the failure of this to be covariant will become a problem at second order in the current. And so there'll be a thing involving currents here, something involving J and J, which the claim will be there will be an interaction that can appear here, which will do the same job as W0 squared did. And it'll, when it appears here, it'll be canceling the non-covariance of this thing. And the thing that'll do that job is something you'll recognize. It's just integral d3x d3y of j0 of x t j0 y t over x minus y. So it's just the Coulomb interaction divided by 2. And so the failure, this explicit non-covariant Hamiltonian, which you know has to be there because the Coulomb interaction exists, is the role it's doing in this language is it's when its appearance here is canceling the non-covariant pieces coming from the virtual photons, and it's making things, if it wasn't there, things would not have been covariant. So what I want to do is compute this, and then once we see the non-covariant part of it, when we put it in here, I want to show you that the coefficient is such that this thing is exactly what you need to cancel it. That's where we're going. All right, so let's start with the first part. So what we know is a mu. So if you know the how this is expressed in terms of creation annihilation operators is the story that we've been talking about, where this thing transforms in a particular way under Lorentz transformations. The particles transform differently. So we have, you know, somewhere an a k lambda, where this is the helicity and that's the momentum, and they're massless. And in that case, the story was that we had a sum over helicities, an integral over momenta, a 2 pi to the 3 halves, which is conventional, a square root of twice the energy, which I'll call omega this time. There's what I was calling u before, but I'm going to call it a polarization vector now. And then we had e to the I k dot x, where the time part of this is the energy again as a function of k. And then we have the antiparticle piece, which in the case of photons, they are their own antiparticle. So we'll have a star k lambda epsilon star u k lambda e to the minus I k dot. And yeah. This? Now this is the interaction energy of these two. You imagine you had two delta functions, for example. This would just give you the Coulomb interaction between them.
Why physically it is, except for the Lorentz events, it is important to have that?
Well, the energy of the helium atom would be wrong. You know, because that's really the Coulomb, the thing that's expressing the Coulomb force in the QED Lagrangian is that. So in the notes that I'm pointing to you all the time, before the chapter 10 is the stuff we've been talking about, where it's the general things to do with Lorentz invariants and quantum mechanics and why that gives you the special things that we're talking about. But the previous chapters are about the electrostatic, you know, electromagnetism. And so if you think of, I'm treating J as if it's just God gives you J. But really, J would be built out of fields. And so if you had done the Schrodinger field, say, where it's a non-relativistic charged particle, then you can calculate, you know, the energy of interaction of, you prepare the charged particles in some state. And in the example I do in the notes is the helium atom. And so the interactions of the charged particles with the Coulomb source of the nucleus, you can just do explicitly the way you normally do and just solve that problem. But the interactions between the electrons is something which would be the interaction Hamiltonian that you're perturbing in. And it's a better approximation than you might have thought. You might have thought that the force between two electrons is not so different than the force between the electron and the nucleus. And so it sounds like perturbation theory shouldn't be that bad because you're perturbing in something which is the same size as something you've kept. But that's actually not the right comparison, because the thing you should be comparing to is the leading order of the interaction with the subleading order of those same interaction, because those are the things you're neglecting, is the powers of the electron-electron interaction, and you've actually done exactly the interaction with the nucleus, and so those are controlled by alpha. So it turns out you actually do, you know, the 4% level, you do a pretty good job of getting the helium atom right, and it's literally the matrix element of this, and this, when you write this in terms of operators, it does include the self-interaction, because as an operator, this thing can have a non-zero matrix element between the same. If I take the matrix element in a single particle state, I get a non-zero answer, which diverges, and which you renormalize into some of the parameters in your problem. But then when you look at the difference between the two particle state matrix element and the two individual one particle state ones, that cancels, and then you're left with the physical thing. So it really is true that this interaction with this coefficient, there's an E hidden in there, but it really is the one that you would have done all these calculations with, and with this normalization. So it's really a beautiful thing. Okay. So what you need to know now for these polarization vectors is these are the ones that were determined by the symmetry arguments, and they're the ones that you would have led to, you would have been led to anyway, if you had been just solving, the classical equations for these waves. And it satisfies that if you took the special frame where K mu was, omega zero zero omega, so this is time, x, y, z, so it's a photon moving in the z direction, then epsilon has to be, it's basically unit vectors in these two directions. So if you use linear polarization, epsilon mu, k equals 1, sorry, not k equals 1, but lambda equals 1, for this k, so let me, would just be, omega 1, 0, omega, sorry, 0, 1, 0, 0, and epsilon mu k lambda equals 2 would be, maybe lambda equals x, and y would be, 0, 0, 1, 0. Or if you're doing circular polarizations, you'd have epsilon mu k lambda equals plus would be, or plus and minus would be 1 over root 2, 0, 1 plus or minus i, 1 plus or minus i, 0. Doesn't matter what basis you use. They both have the property. What we're going to want to do is use, so this is in a specific frame, what I've given you here, in the special frame. So what we're going to do is stick this into this, along the lines of what we did here. And the only thing that's tricky now is we have to do the sum over the polarizations. And I want to use those explicitly to do that sum. So we're going to do 0, time ordered product of a mu of x, a nu of y. So it'll be the same kind of thing. It'll be a theta of x minus y naught. And then we'll do the matrix element of these guys, two of them, with x to the left. And these are the things that we're going to stick in the matrix element. So we're going to have a sum over lambda, and a sum over lambda. Let me kind of do the steps, and then I'll erase the things that we're going to go that are going to go away in the end. In the end of the day, what's going to happen is that we have to have a creation operator here, because we have to, otherwise we annihilate the ground state. So we're going to get this guy. And then once we've got a one particle state here, we have to destroy it. So we're going to, in this guy, have to take this guy. And there'll be a delta function, because we have to destroy the particle that was created. So there'll be a delta function that will start off with the sum over, independent sums over momentum and spin. But the delta function that's required to make this matrix element not zero will make them equal to each other. So we'll be left with a sum over lambda and an integral d3k, and we'll have our 2 pi cubed, and our twice frequency, and then we'll have an epsilon mu k lambda, and we'll have this guy here, epsilon star nu k lambda. And then we'll have the e to the I kx minus y. That's it, I think. And then we'll have the thing where we have the other order. So we'll have plus x goes to y and mu goes to nu. And the only thing that's, everything else, if we didn't have this factor, this would now turn into this, and all the things would go through as before. So the only thing we have to track through is what the sum over lambda is in this particular case, given that these are the two polarization states. So we want to evaluate, and we want to do it not just in the special frame. We want to do it in the arbitrary frame, because we're integrating over all k. We want to know what it is for every k. So So in the special frame, sum over lambda of epsilon mu k lambda epsilon star nu k lambda. That's easy to write. It's going to be the dyadic of this with this. So that's going to be a matrix. You know, if I take 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, plus 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, I get 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0. And all these are zeros. So it's just a little unit matrix in the space that is perpendicular to the k's. So this would be, if I call this pi mu nu, it depends only on, it should depend only on the direction of motion, right? It, nothing in the, those epsilons cares about the value of omega. So this should be a function of k, but it should only depend on its direction. So let's think of k hat as being the unit direction, unit normal, unit vector in the direction of k. And so what we know is in the special frame is that pi ij of k is delta ij minus ki kj. And we know that the time pieces are all zero. Right, because this is just saying if I, k is in this special frame, it's just the unit vector in the third direction. And so this just says I take the unit matrix in three directions and I subtract off the one in the z direction, then I'll get that matrix. And what we want is, what this is, not in, if we don't assume this to be the special frame, and the hard way to do this is what we should in principle do is we would do the Lorentz transformation that takes us from this frame to the general frame where k is arbitrary, and then we do the explicit Lorentz, to take that explicit Lorentz matrix and act on this thing and get what we get. And that's that'll give you the right answer. Yeah?
The k should be the unit vectors, right?
Yeah. It's just,
just
thank you. That's the important one. Yeah. yeah. Good. Thank you for that. I think that's the only place I did that, right? Good. So, but the faster way to do this is that you can guess the answer, right? It's got to be an anti-symmetric matrix, and it's got to be something which cares about k. It's got to not depend on anything except for the direction of k, and it cares about the split between space and time. Because there's two directions, there's two vectors that are perpendicular to epsilon, one of which is in the time direction, one of which is in the direction of motion direction. So if I think of, I define n mu to be in this particular frame, 1, 0, 0, 0, and I think of k mu as being the one we've been using as a special one, then what I want is I want to make a symmetric combination that's a function of n and k, which has the property that when I specialize to these particular values for these guys, this will be time-like and this will be light-like. But when I specialize to these specific ones, I get this. That'll be, that has to be the answer, right? And if you do that, then it's not such a hard thing to guess. And because if I guess it, it's not so hard thing to guess, but if you, if I did it on the board, I would guess it wrong. So let me, So what you know is it's got to be something which has an eta mu nu in it with a coefficient. And it's got to have another coefficient, which is n mu p nu plus p mu n mu. And it's got to have another coefficient, which is p mu, p nu. And it's got to have another coefficient, which is n mu, n nu. It's just a question of what the coefficients are. And so what we have to do is arrange it so that it satisfies that it's perpendicular to k, perpendicular to n, because that's what the epsilons are. If I take that, the definition and I contract that with n or with epsilon, with k, I get 0. And it has to be normalized, so that it has to give me 1 in the subspace, which corresponds to the to the directions perpendicular to p and k. That the normalization will make that 1. And so I'm just going to tell you what the answer turns out to be. So it's this times p0 minus that over free vector squared. M's a p lambda p lambda over a three vector squared. I've done that right. And so in this, I've used p instead of k, so this is pi of p. So p mu is basically p zero and three momentum p. P zero equals anything, doesn't matter.
I think the index on the second end should be a nu.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. And n is time length. So we can just check, you know, if I take the special choice where p is equal to this and n is equal to, yeah, p is equal to this, n is equal to this, then you can verify that that we're getting what we want. So for example, let's take the case where we take both these guys to be zero. So this becomes eta 0, 0, which is minus 1. And here we're going to get n0 p0. So we're going to get 2, n0 is 1. So we're going to get 2 times p0 squared minus p0 squared. So that'll be p0 squared over p squared. And here we're going to get 1, and we're going to get minus pz squared over p squared. So those will cancel, and we're going to get 0. I did that right. Did I do that right? The one I'm worried about is this. So it was minus 1. So we've got 2 times the energy minus the energy is the energy. And then the energy is P. Oh no, actually it's not P, not 0, 0. Yes, right. That's the one. So I told you here that this was the energy squared. So the P zero squared term here cancels this. But the P vector squared cancels that and gives me a plus 1, and that takes out the minus 1. That's what I was worried about. So that's giving you that's 0. You can go through the same exercise with ij, and you can see that these guys are going to be, the n's only contribute in the time direction. And so you can go through the exercise and see that that's doing what you want. So that's what the answer has to be. All right. So now what we want to do is put that into here, right? So we've got and so the rest of the story, you know, the change of variables, the step function, it's going to go through like it did before. M will be 0. And that we're going to get this answer, but we're going to get this pi mu nu is going to appear in that answer. And so that's going to thing that's going to, it's going to look non-covariant. So we're going to try integral d4p 2 pi to the fourth times pi delta, I guess. And then we have pi mu nu of p hat. And you know, one of the things you might worry about is I was making a distinction between whether or not p zero is the p you're integrating over, or p zero is the thing built out of the momentum, and that doesn't matter here because it doesn't depend on p zero, because the p zero is always canceling in that expression. And so you kind of see that this is nice and covariant, and these are the ones that are not so covariant. And so those are the ones that you could worry about giving you a problem here. And these guys are not really a problem because, you know, if I take the second order guy, if I take the, I'm just going to write this, I'm going to write the contribution of this in here. So call that S2. That'll be minus I squared over 2 integral d4x d4y J mu of x, J nu of y of the T A mu of x, A nu of y. So I'm calculating 0, 0, the vacuum matrix element in the photon sector. There's a covariant piece, which is coming from this guy. Then this piece, it always involves a P contracted against a J. So the P mu, if I go to, this is an integral over momentum, and I can do the integrals over x, because I once I write the Fourier expansion, I can write this in momentum space. And then whenever I have a P mu contracted with a J mu in momentum space, that's the Fourier transform. Of real space, partial mu j mu, and that's something we know is zero, because that's the statement of current conservation for electric charge. So what's happening in this particular case is that these contributions to physical things are not, although they're not covariant, that doesn't matter because they're not contributing to anything physical, and they're not doing that because of the conservation of electric charge, and that is the when we went through the first class, the story of why A had this form and why this was not a four vector. It was only a four vector up to a gauge transformation. The gauge transformations are what required us to couple the photon to a conserved current. And so the fact that those terms are dropping out of this is the expression of gauge invariance fixing that part of the non-Lorentz invariance of the problem. So this is kind of part of the magic of gauge invariance, as we're going to see in more detail later on. But this is the one I want to focus on, because that's, you're never contracting a current against a P here. That involves two N's. So this contains the piece minus 1/2 integral d4x, d4y. When J, and I'm going to evaluate it in the frame where N is this. This will be J0 of x and t. J0 of y and t, and we have an I integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth e to the I p at x minus y over p squared minus I delta, and then I'm writing down here now p lambda over p squared. And this P, you remember, could be anything. The frequency part of this, the energy part of P squared, could be anything. Now the free lunch part of things is, I want to convince you that that's the Coulomb interaction.
Also, a general comment on the like 2 pi factors on the denominator. So
yeah,
you have like 2 pi to the fourth, but it shouldn't it be like 2 pi to the 2, because we have like, you know, 3, we had 3 halves, and now we add one more, like one extra p integral.
You're happy with the 3 here, right?
Oh, no, right, because it's like 2 fields that are multiplied together.
Right. And then there's the other one comes from here, that one. So the thing, so these are basically going to cancel. The pole here, you don't need the delta anymore because the p squareds are going to go to zero together. So the thing that I I don't, you know, maybe you're just happy with this, is that the claim is that this 1 over p squared Fourier transforms to the Coulomb interaction. And the thing that I want you to see is that the 2 pi's work too. So what's the simplest way to see that? Simplest way to see this would be that 1 over p squared, you know, any factors of p in here are like derivatives acting on this on the outside. So 1 over p squared here is like writing 1 over del squared minus del squared in front of this. If I wrote 1 over del squared in front of this, that would be giving me the p squared. And so what does that mean? That means the Green's function for del squared. And the Green's function for del squared is it's, you know, it's 1 over 4 pi x minus y is equal to the delta function. So 1 over del squared is basically that. And so the normalization will be, if I've done this right.
Yeah, there's one pop in front, so it's good.
Yeah, but I'm worried about the sign here now. It's the, again, the sign. Because that's a plus. And that, I'm worried about that sign in particular. Because as it, this sign would have been good, because this is exactly what we need to cancel it. And so the, what did I do wrong? No, the eyes work in the sense that this eye is going to come out front, and that's going to cancel. Where's my S matrix? It's going to cancel this eye. Oh, but this is going to, that's it. No, it works. That sign saves me, right? Right. So this is this minus sign. So this is a minus 1 over 4 pi. So we've got, altogether, we've got plus 1 over 8 pi integral d4x, d4y, j0 of x, t, or x, I should just leave, the times here are still arbitrary, j0 of y. X minus y. And then we've still got the integral. Well, there's the factor of I comes up front. Integral d4p, 2 pi to the fourth, e to the I, p dot x minus y. Then this is just the four-dimensional delta function, right, of x minus y. Except that, no, that can't be. That's not good.
Well, you should separate, I think, the time back and integral. Time back integral eliminates.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's so what I've done here is I can't independently do this. This trick here is too cute, right? Because I'm writing this as 1 over del squared. When I write it as 1 over del squared acting on this thing, and then when I convert it into the here, I've done the integral over momentum already in the space direction. The thing I haven't touched is time. So the only guy that's left to be done here is the frequency, yeah. So dp0 over 2 pi is the minus I p0 x0 minus y0. And so that's the thing that says that delta of x0 minus y0. And so that's the last thing that, so I have an integral d4x of an integral d3y, x of t and y of t. So these are space directions. And that should be what this first order term turns into. So now I'm comparing that to minus I integral d4x of h, where h is this. So it's a 1 over 8 pi squared j0 of x t, j0 of y t over x, y. And that's, and hallelujah. So you see that it's exactly doing the cancellation in this concrete, you know, realistic example that was happening in the toy model we had before. That's the bottom line. So the non-covariant interactions are not hypothetical. You know, real interactions where we know that they exist because that's an honest to God thing that you measure is involved in the cancellation of these kind of non-covariant parts of the photon propagator, is the message of that. Good. So the punchline is, yeah?
How dy0 was eliminated from?
It was this delta function. So this delta function does the integral over time, and it just gives me, well, there's one integral over time left, but that's also over there. Yeah, so the dy0 I did with this delta function. It sets y0 equal to x0.
We have two time integrals, right?
Right, so the x0 one is still left, but the y0 one I'm doing with this. It's a d3y and a d4x. Mm-hmm. And the d4x is the one that's over there. That works. So,
okay,
I
think what Afshin is saying, like, there's also a, there's like only one time integral on the, like, on this expression here.
Yeah.
And
also true here, right?
Yeah, but I mean, there should be none here because the time in, the only time integral gets canceled by the delta function.
I forgot to write the space integral, but it's this is the same as what we have over there, right? There's a time integral here and a space integral, and here there's just a space integral.
Yeah, but there's still like a time, there's still a time integral here, whereas here you have like a delta function on the time back.
No, so this started off being an integral d4x d4y.
Oh, okay.
And then I did the time integral with that delta function, and so then I erased it.
Okay.
And I should have then erased this, but I didn't. Yeah. But it's they really are giving the same answer. So now the punchline is that so at face value you'd say, well, how do I guess all these non-covariant interactions? And the canonical quantization is what gives them to you, which is why we do it. And so I want to do that for the toy model, just to explicitly see that you're going to get that right interaction, and then do it again for the Coulomb interaction. And the Coulomb interaction involves canonically quantizing the electromagnetic field, which is, I'm not sure if you guys would have, when you did, you know, if you did QED in your introductory quantum field theory course, I don't know if they canonically quantized it or how they did it. So who has seen canonical quantization of the electromagnetic field? So several have you, yeah, okay. So this will be repeat for some and not for others, and it won't take very long, so it's, so that's what we'll do. And it's kind of, it's...
I mean, it was more like an argument they took for each of the four AMUs. It's a like treating each of the four AMUs as a Klein-Gordon field, and we know how that's quantized. And then was a degree of freedom argument with the gauge to eliminate some of the. And then we got the this expression of polarization that you wrote here.
Yeah.
We got that by like a degree of freedom argument.
But you didn't talk about constraints.
In the
sense of you've got canonical momentum and positions, and they're constrained. They're subject to constraints. So that's the thing that I'm going to talk about. So it sounds like there may or may not be an overlap there, but we will see when we get there. All right. So, but canonical quantization in general, who's happy with that? So who's seen canonical quantization, you know, for fields? This is, yeah. So you're kind of basically happy with canonical quantization. So what I'll do is I'll just canonically quantize these systems, and I won't kind of go through the, you know, reminder of how you'll see in the doing of it what the reminder is of canonical methods, and then ask if there's something that comes up. That's not a question, is it? So ask if there's something that comes up. So the point of this next thing is that canonical quantization is useful because it, for relativistic physics, because it automatically generates the non-covariant terms in H needed for covariance of the S matrix. So let's take the example. So now for canonical quantization, what we do is we specify the action, right? So the action is the integral, you know, would have been the integral d time of the Lagrangian if you're doing, you know, particle mechanics. But our Lagrangian is always a local thing because we want our Hamiltonian to be a local thing. So that's integral d3x of some Lagrangian density. And so that means that our action is an integral d4x of the Lagrangian density. And what's nice about that is that making the action be invariant, say Lorentz invariant, is the same thing as making L be a Lorentz scalar, because this is already transforming in such a way that the integral of a scalar would be invariant. And so it makes as opposed to commuting with a Hamiltonian, it makes the condition of invariance very clean. And then once we have the action, what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to take the Lagrangian, or we're supposed to calculate, so this is a function of the variables. And in our case, let's start off with the case of a real field psi of x. So we'll have a function of Lagrangian and its derivative, let's say. And so what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to think of the derivatives. You know, we have space-time derivatives here, and to make this thing Lorentz scalar, we have to contract all those indices in a Lorentz invariant way. So it's kind of easy to do. And then what we're supposed to do is pick apart the time and the space derivatives, define the canonical momentum to be variation of the action with respect to the time derivative, psi dot, where psi dot is just the dt of psi. So it sounds very non-covariant. And then what we do is we define the Hamiltonian density to be the sum over all fields of pi for each field times psi dot for that field minus the Lagrangian density. And we're supposed to think of this as a function of fields, spatial derivatives of fields, and time derivative of fields. And what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to think of this as something which we invert to get the time derivatives as a function of pi, psi, and grad psi. And then we plug that into here, and that will be a function of the momenta, the spatial gradients, and the fields. That's the algorithm. And so, I mean, the cases where you can't solve this, I mean, when you say things.
For example, say that I can only solve a few of them.
Yeah.
And then I won't be able to replicate the phi dot for all fields as a function of the momentum.
Right.
But I can still do the jump transform.
Yeah, there's several directions to go. One of them is, just bring everybody else up to speed. So where you went is where I'm going. And so it's the thing is, suppose what happens if you can't invert this relationship? And what's going to happen for us in electromagnetism is that the momentum that corresponds to the zero component of A is just going to be zero, because the action doesn't depend on it. There's no A zero dot term. And so that's an example of one of these cases where you can't solve that one just because pi is zero. And so the general issue is, if you have something like that, those are what you would call constraints. Those are obstructions to the inverting of this relationship. And you know that they're going to be a problem, because in the end of the day, you'd like to, when you quantize, impose the canonical quantization relations, something like psi of x and t, phi of y and t. You'd like that to be, you know, I times delta of x minus y or something like that, or minus I, or something like that. But if pi is zero, for example, that's clearly inconsistent, right? And so then that's the problem. So there's two approaches, one of which is if the constraint's often telling you that some of your variables are really functions of the other variables. And that's what happens in electromagnetism for A0. And so if you can just explicitly solve that constraint, which is I think what you're saying, then just you just say, well, that's not an independent variable. I just regard it as being that function of the other variables, and then quantize the other variables and see what happens. But there's another way you can go where you don't, you know, that's only useful if you can actually can solve the constraint, and you can always solve the constraint. So if you can't solve the constraint, then there's this theory of constrained Hamiltonian systems where you can set up a generalized commutation, a generalized bracket essentially, which deals with the fact that your variables were not all independent. And that's the procedure which you can do more generally in the sense that you don't need to solve the constraint to set up that quantization. If you want to kind of know who's, you know, what are the right quantization conditions, then what you do is you set up the analog of the, in the classical side, the analog of the, instead of the Poisson brackets, it's these Dirac brackets, which are kind of a generalized things that are built in the constraint. And then the statement would be that the Dirac bracket canonical relationship turns into the, you know, the quantum one. And which is more useful depends on whether you can solve your constraint explicitly or not. What's nice about QED is that there's two kinds of constraints that come in, one of which you can solve explicitly, and that's just the Coulomb law, because it's linear. And then the other one is you'll see, you know, these fields are going to, you know, the divergence of them will be zero, for example, and so that there'll be a kind of an easier to deal with constraint. So I'm going to be able to just be explicit about what the solutions are. Whereas in a non-abelian gauge theory, you can't be that explicit, or gravity, for example, you can't be that explicit. And so then it depends on what you're trying to do, what's the most useful way to do approach it.
So is there a systematic procedure to determine which constraints?
Yeah, I think so. It depends on what you mean by independent. There's first class constraints and second class constraints, and then what you do is you identify a sufficient set that there's a basis of them, so that there's a the procedure basically is that you take the constraint and you evolve it in time to see if it generates new constraints, and that's how you generate the full set of constraints. And then once you've got to the point where evolving all of the constraints in forward in time is not giving you any new constraints, then that's the complete set. And so then you decide, you know, how do you deal with that complete set?
Yeah, I think I was asking because of the fact of gravity.
Yeah.
The anti-identities, for example, which
right.
I don't know about, but still they reduce the number of degrees.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, I was hoping whether somehow there is a systematic procedure, some algorithm.
There is, and it's there's no free lunch, of course, right? but because a lot of this formalism was actually derived, people could have done it for electromagnetism and gauge theories, but they really did it for gravity. That's what they had in mind. So there's these papers and reviews by Claudio Teitelboehm and what's his name? Mark.
Hino.
Yeah, Hino. Thank you. Dirac developed the theory of constrained Hamiltonian systems, and they specifically apply it to gravity to identify what all the constraints are and which ones are first class, which ones are second class, what are the Poisson brackets, and so a lot has been done on that. So there's good reviews on that by those two in particular, but there's probably others. And the go-to review I'm thinking of, and it's all, when I was a student, there was already reviews. So they were kind of fresh reviews then, so they've been around for a long time now. So it's I'm trying to think. I think I know Teitelboehm wrote, and it is in Nuovo Cimento, I think it was. I can try and find it if you're interested. And it's true that those are examples where the solving of the constraint's not easy. Although I think in some cases the momentum constraints I think can be solved. That's one of the things the loop quantum gravity I think does, and then. But the energy, you know, it's not, there's no simple, this is now turn the crank and you're done kind of thing. Okay. All right. So what I want to do is do this for the toy example, which is simple, and then do it again for electromagnetism, which is these other complications going on. But the toy example has the advantage that it allows us to look at the generation of the non-canonical, non-covariant terms without having to deal with this constraint business. So so let's take the example where, I guess the first thing we have to do is we're heading towards perturbation theory. So we have to have a free Lagrangian and a perturbed Lagrangian. So I'm just going to write down the free Lagrangian because I think you've seen it before. But it's not hard to guess the free Lagrangian because you're looking for something which gives you a Hamiltonian, which is the sum of creation and annihilation operators, you know, some of the form A star A. So you're looking for something quadratic in the fields, and it has to be the Lorentz invariant. And it's, you know, and you think about how many terms can you write down? There's not a lot of terms. You can write down psi squared. You can write down a constant. You can write down derivative of psi contracted with derivative of psi, and that's pretty much it. And then you can always choose one of those coefficients to be one by rescaling the field, and that's typically you choose the derivative one to be one. And then the one in front of the psi squared is the one that will turn out to be the mass, and you get that by when you calculate the energy, you see the energy is the square root of p squared plus something. And so once you've done all that, the Lagrangian would have been, you know, d mu psi d mu psi minus m squared over 2 psi squared, possibly minus a constant, but the constant's not going to play any role in what we're doing. That's L naught. And then the interaction Lagrangian is the one I want to do is minus W mu D mu W. Or first let's do the, if we had had minus, you know, lambda over 4 factorial psi to the fourth, which is the first example we did, which had no derivatives, then if we just turn the crank here, what would happen is that we would have said that the pi, which is the derivative of the action with respect to psi dot, if I write this out, and this is plus 1/2 psi dot squared because of the metric. And then it's minus 1/2 grad psi squared minus m squared over 2 psi squared minus constant. So if I take the derivative, this is just psi dot. And so if I now do this construction of H, it's going to be pi psi dot minus the Lagrangian where I trade psi dot for pi. So it's minus 1/2 pi squared plus 1/2 grad psi squared plus 1/2 m squared psi squared plus the constant. And I'm imagining here the Lagrangian is L naught plus L interaction. And so then this would just go along for the ride, and I get plus, you know, lambda over 4 factorial psi to the fourth. And so this just combines, so this is pi. So this just becomes plus pi squared over 2. So I tell you that because this part is what we're going to call H naught. And then here's our H interaction that we were using, which is, you know, lo and behold, it's a scalar because this had to be a scalar because the Lagrangian had to be a scalar. And so all you did was you changed the sign here to get to there because of this sign. And so the existence of Hamiltonian interactions which are scalars is kind of this was the example we used. But the really interesting case is where we use, instead of this, we use W mu D mu psi, because that's the one I want to see it generate this non-covariant term. And I want to get it with the right coefficient to do all the cancellation that I said was happening. So if we repeat the exercise, the important thing here is that if I write out, this involves a psi dot here, right? Because we've got a minus W0 psi dot minus W dot grad psi. And so this changes because now we've got a minus W0 term. And so that means when we solve for psi dot's going to be pi plus W0. And so our Hamiltonian, I want to erase this. This will still be what our unperturbed Hamiltonian was. H0 was this. But our full Hamiltonian, including the interaction, will be pi psi dot minus L. And so we're going to get pi times pi plus W naught minus L. And L starts off with psi dot squared. So we have minus 1/2 pi plus W naught squared. And then everything else is the same as before, grad psi squared plus m squared over 2 psi squared plus c. And then now we have to include the interaction term here. So we had a minus, so now we have a plus W0 times pi plus W0. And we have a plus W dot grad psi. So this is the free Lagrangian, this is the pi phi psi dot, and this is the interaction Lagrangian. And so this is equal to, So the pi squareds did what they did before, right? We've got a pi squared minus a half pi squared. And so we have a half pi squared plus this, plus this, plus this, which is what h naught was. So I'll call it h naught. And then what's left is we've got pi w naught plus.
So here you're switching from, okay, so you were in the 5-4, you know, like the 5-4 interaction, but now you're considering the.
Yeah, I said that I just showed the 5-4 just because, just to confirm that that was doing what it was supposed to do, and it gave us a scalar. But now I'm going back and just repeating the exercise where I use this one, which is because that was the one that we had a non-covariant piece for, and I just want to see what happens.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure if I've done this right. Anyway, let me write what I've got here, and then we can always cry later. Yeah. So here we go. We got pi w naught, then we've got a minus, the cross term here is going to be the twos will cancel, and I have pi, so these are going to cancel, and I'm just left with the pi w naught. And then I have w naught squared, plus w naught squared minus a half w naught squared. And then I still have the plus w dot grad psi. That a half is bothering me. That's minus a half plus one. Right, this plus a half w squared, but the two is bothering me. Let me make sure I haven't made a mistake here before we press on. So this is actually right, but I think I lied to you before. That's it's all about normalizations. And so I gave you where I was headed. So let's actually press on and see what should happen is when we look at the non-covariant piece, it should cancel this term here. So this and this, that looks kind of like the covariant thing we started off with, right? Because we had the covariant thing was w naught psi dot. And in the old days, for the free Lagrangian, psi dot was pi. And so this, you know, the combination of the w naught pi plus w dot grad pi, that looks a lot like the thing that would have been a covariant interaction. And this is the extra bit. And the extra bit, compared to what I said before, I've got a half here, whereas when we did this story before, I had a one here. And the one was what we needed to cancel things. But I was using, I think, the normalization for a complex scalar when I did that previous argument, and this is the correct normalization for a real scalar. If we had done this with a complex scalar, conventionally you would not have the half here and you'd have complex conjugates. You'd have a separate pi for a field and its complex conjugate, and so everything goes through here without the half. But I think it should be true that if I just take this and I calculate what the cancellation, it should work, because the for a real field, there should be half as big a contribution coming from the non-covariant piece in the correlation function of two derivatives, and so the cancellation should go through even though there's a half here. So we can check that. All right. So we have. Our S matrix was 1 minus I integral H interaction D4x minus 1 half integral D4x D4y of time ordered product of x of y interaction. And I want to track the non-covariant guy here. So I'm gonna so this is one. I'm gonna minus I over two integral d4x of w0 squared plus other things. And then I have minus a half integral d4x, d4y. And if I take the piece here, I'm going to have to tell you what the correlation function is for pi and phi. Is there a simpler way? Well, let's just track it out. So we got W0 of X, W0 of Y. The time order product, the thing I want to follow is in the linear interaction, these guys. So the thing involving W0 is pi. We'll have a time ordered product of pi pi of y. And unfortunately, so I want to, I painted myself in a corner here. Let me just make sure I don't stray too far from what I know is true. So the thing I gotta check is, let me actually write everything here. So it's just not just this, it's what's making it complicated for me to just so you're all up to speed here. If this had been W naught squared, I would have declared victory, because that's what we needed last time to cancel the non-covariant piece in the correlation function of the derivatives of psi. And I got a half here, and so the half is coming about, so I don't think I made a mistake here, right? If I just go through this exercise, W naught squared comes from this term, which is going to minus a half, plus this term, which is a plus a half. So I think we're basically, the half has to be there, or plus one. And I suspect what's happening is that the in my notes that I'm working from, where the W naught squared was, it was a complex field that was involved, and I said, I think the cancellation is still going to go through. The problem is going to be in this, so the thing is, we have to identify the non-covariant part of this quadratic piece to make sure that it has the same coefficient involving W naught squared. And what makes that subtle is the Lagrangian is now not, or the Hamiltonian, interaction Hamiltonian, which is this piece. The thing that's linear in W is this, and that's not coming to you as a straightforwardly as a gradient of psi times something, because pi is playing the role of psi dot, and that's okay, because when we were doing the canonical, when we were doing the calculating everything in perturbation theory previously, we were using the quantization of the field and psi dot in particular, how it depended on the creation annihilation operators in the way that you would have done in the interaction picture, which is where the free Hamiltonian is what you're using to determine how everything evolves in time. And so the momentum that's relevant there is psi dot. So this really is playing the role of W mu, partial mu psi. But what we want to cancel is not the entire W zero squared term. We want to cancel just the piece coming from the differentiating the step function, because that's the non-covariant part. And so the thing I need to do is to pull out for you just the part coming from the derivative of the step function. And so to do that, I'm going to need to write more than just the w0 squared, the w0 term, which is what I wrote before. So what we're going to get is we're going to get w0 times pi plus w dot grad psi at x, time ordered product. W0 pi plus w grad psi at y. And the failure to the thing that was coming from differentiating the step function, we should be able to read off the normalization of this from here. And that's the thing that I'm not seeing yet. I would like to say that this has got the non-covariant part of this has got a it's got a delta of x minus y. It's got a delta of I don't need the delta of a time. It's going to involve w zero squared, and I'd like the coefficient just to be one from here. I guess it'll be an I, because the way the spatial delta function comes. It comes because we had a
isn't it better to write pi in terms of psi, in terms of the field, in a way that the derivative would be clear?
Well, the thing is that we're going to take if you remember the way the argument works when I did this morning.
You're going to take the derivative outside of the time.
Well, remember I took d mu and I took d nu prime of the time ordered product of psi of x prime, and the pieces that were dangerous was where we took this thing and we wrote it as a there was a step function, you know, theta of x naught minus y naught, and then we plus, you know, x or x prime naught. We have x naught minus x naught prime of psi of x prime. Then we have a theta of x naught prime minus x naught psi of x prime psi of x. And the dangerous guys were the ones where, you know, so there's, I have one derivative hitting the step function and the other derivative hits the field. There's two terms that were like that. And then we had one term where both derivatives hit the step function and we got a derivative of the delta function. The derivative of the delta function involved the commutator. So what happens is that if you differentiate this thing twice, that happens here and it happens here, but there's a sign change here. So what happens is you end up getting a commutator of psi with psi. And so the thing involving the derivative of the delta function went away because these fields were the same. But when I had the derivative acting on the field and another derivative acting on the delta function, the same kind of thing happened, is that the derivative on the delta function here comes with the opposite sign because we reversed the arguments. And so then you got the commutator of psi with the derivative of psi. And then the spatial derivatives of psi commute with psi, but the time derivative of psi doesn't because that's a momentum. And so the thing is you need to know the canonical momentum, the failure of the momentum to commute. And so talking it through with you now, I can see that what I need to do here is the thing that should be need canceling is what happens what's making this what's making me flounder here is that we had the explicit derivatives here, and in particular, it's the time derivatives that mattered for this argument. And I've changed them for pi, and that makes the commutation relations with pi and psi clearest, because in this canonical formalism, the way you define who commutes with whom is you ask the momentum and the fields to not commute. But in this way of writing it, it's not clear how much of the W naught squared term came from the covariant piece where the derivatives are acting on here, and how much of it comes from differentiating the non-covariant piece, the differentiating the set functions. And I'm just trying to see if there's a simple way to pull out that coefficient. And what, you know, what happened this morning was we had two terms. The derivative hit this, and the other derivative hit this. So we had a term where d mu hits the step function, d mu prime hits the field. And then the other one where d mu prime hits the step function, d mu hits the field. So we had two commutators, and that added together to give us a factor of two. And that factor of two was what killed this factor of two, and it made it cancel W naught squared. We didn't have a factor of two here, so we would have not had the factor of two here. And so we had there's no two in this W naught squared, and that two that we were getting from the step functions was killing that two and allowing them to cancel.
Can we first change?
We can, but the thing that's subtle there is so if we did that, the question is, do we replace pi with, are we using the relationship this one, or are we replacing pi with psi dot? And in the interaction, so let's just try it. So if we do what you say, let's just do that. So this would be, so H interaction is I can just drop the H naught, right? So H interaction would be, so pi is going to be psi dot minus W naught plus 1/2. Let's just follow the linear pieces plus the gradient piece. So that's going to be that'll be psi dot W naught plus W dot grad psi. And this guy will combine with this guy to give me a minus 1/2 V naught squared. So yeah.
Wrong psi.
What's that?
Wrong psi. D psi. That's the.
This is the W mu D mu psi, right? Exactly. So, if we go through this argument here, we would have had we had twice delta function of x naught minus x naught prime. Then so let's say we differentiate that guy here, so we would have had a commutator of psi of x with psi of x prime dot. And that's coming from these guys. And so to evaluate this commutator, we're going to need to know what it is in terms of pi. So I guess what we do is we write psi dot is equal to pi plus W naught. W naught commutes with psi, so it's going to be, this is the same as psi with pi. So that will be, I always forget this, x with p is going to be minus I times the gradient, right? So it's x. Right, I. So this is the thing that should be I times delta x minus x prime. That's our 2i. And so then we're not, I've made it worse by having the sign change. What bothers me is that the split between H naught and H interaction, it matters if you do it with pi as your variable or if psi dot as your variable. That's part of the problem. Actually, I'm just thinking out loud now. So it's, if we had done the split with H psi dot as our variable, we would have had basically psi dot squared minus W naught psi dot minus L. It would have been H naught minus W naught psi dot plus W naught psi dot no, that can't be right because that's just canceling completely. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to go back and if I've managed to wind down the clock here, I'll have to come back to you next time and tell you what happened here, because that's I've confused myself in a way which I did not expect. If I had not written that 1/2 and I just declared success, you might have been happy with that. But I didn't. And so so that's my homework for next time. I'll deal with that. And then the Coulomb one is more straightforward. The Coulomb one, the cancellation of the Coulomb interaction goes through much like I described, but the canonical, the new feature of the canonical interaction, it does give you the Coulomb interaction the way you expect to, but the complications there are coming from these constraints that you were asking about, that we're going to find that the step where we have to solve for psi dot in terms of these other variables is not so straightforward because essentially we have a redundant set of variables. The A fields are not, if we take the A fields as our variables, and we should, because the electric and magnetic fields, they satisfy the Bianchi identities, and so they're not independent. And the point of the A fields is that they are unconstrained, although they're redundant. And so the it's the redundancy of the A fields that's going to be leading us into trouble here and not allow us to solve these definitions of momenta for the velocities. And so the but because it's linear, we'll be able to deal with that when we get there. And I apologize for how this melted down at the end. That's it bothers me that factor of two is not coming to us. But thank you for coming. See you next week.